As you all come to settle in, I'll just make some very, very brief opening remarks. My name's Garner Clancy. I'm adjunct lecturer at the Sydney Institute of Criminology, which is housed upstairs, and we're very pleased to be co-hosting this event, but in partnership with Department of Human Services Juvenile Justice. Can I say to you, as you do move into the few remaining vacant seats, that we had an amazing response to this event. Over 260 people wanted to be here. Sadly, we had to turn some away, but a fantastic response. Before I begin the sort of more formal proceedings, can I acknowledge and pay respect to the traditional owners of the land upon which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It's upon their ancestral lands that the University of Sydney is built. As we share our own knowledge, teaching, learning and research practices within this university, may we also pay respect to the knowledge embedded forever within the Aboriginal custodianship of country. I just want to make a few very brief comments before we do begin. Some housekeeping. Toilets are downstairs. We are recording much of this event, so there will be podcasts available within the weeks to come, and we'll place some presentations and the like on the website. You'll all be notified of that before it occurs. I can also say that there will be a photographer racing around, grabbing some happy snaps occasionally. Please just continue to listen and learn whilst those photos are being taken. I do want to again acknowledge the sponsorship of Human Services Juvenile Justice. This is the second in a series of three events, and we're very pleased to have the partnership with Juvenile Justice to put on these public education events. The first was focusing on the facts of juvenile offending. This event is focusing on Aboriginal young people and crime. And the next event that we hope to have a date scheduled in very soon, which is likely to be May or June, will focus on mental health, adolescent brain development and the relationship with offending behaviour. So three quite important topics that we've been pleased to be able to bring to you all and to those people who listen to the podcast afterwards. Can I say we have a fantastic lineup of speakers, as you all know, because you're here, but the program tonight will run as follows. We'll have comments from Edwina Crawford, Manager of Aboriginal Strategic Coordination Unit for Department of Human Services Juvenile Justice, to commence. Edwina's going to link this event to the previous event and talk about some of the data that emerged from that prior event around Aboriginal offending, Aboriginal young people's involvement in crime. We'll then move to Kate Sullivan, who's kindly taken a little bit of time out of her PhD write-up at the moment to be with us this evening to, I think, bring us some really important and vital information about desistance. She's been looking at some work around why people stop offending, and I think that's a question that we don't often ask or ask often enough. We've also lucky enough to have Anthony Poulsen from Tikandi to talk to us about the experience of Tikandi and to illustrate some of the positive elements of that form of intervention, but to also get us thinking outside of just the juvenile justice system. We're very clear that many of the reasons why young people come into the juvenile justice system are for reasons other than their criminal justice concerns, so we want to broaden the perspective a little bit this evening. We're then very fortunate to have Bob Debus, who many of you will know as former Minister for Home Affairs and the former New South Wales Attorney General. Bob's going to talk about some of those experiences, but also some experiences through chairing a committee that looked at overrepresentation of Indigenous young people in the criminal justice system. And that was a national inquiry that I think gives him and those people involved in that inquiry an amazing insight into what is and isn't working across the country. So that's the way we'll proceed this evening. We've created lots of opportunities for questions. I'll be running around with the microphone, so if you are interested in asking a question to any of the speakers, please use the microphone when we get to that point so everyone gets to hear. I'm conscious there are a lot of people in the room, so please do take the opportunity to use the microphone. Without further ado, can I please welcome Edwina Crawford to the lectern? Thank you.
Well, before I begin, I'd just also like to acknowledge the traditional owners, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, for whose land Sydney University is built, and I'd like to acknowledge those elders both past and present. I'd also like to acknowledge our panel members today, Kate Sullivan from CAPER, Anthony Paulson, who's not up in the front row over on the side there, which is not good, from Tikandi and Innabarra, as well as Bob Dubas, who has been instrumental in New South Wales in establishing a number of initiatives that have seen, such as Tikandi Innabarra, as well as Aboriginal Circle Sentencing and Aboriginal Community Justice Groups, which have done an enormous amount of work to help involve Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the criminal justice system. And that's something that's as significant as reducing reoffending, I think, and is something that Bob's leadership during his time as Attorney General was incredibly significant here in New South Wales. Of course, our Acting Chief Executive, John Hubby, and as well as our DHS Director General, Jenny Mason, who was a partner in crime with Bob Dubas at the time, that a lot of very specific and influential flagship Indigenous and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander programs were starting here in New South Wales. So I'd also like to thank Ghana as well. For all your help, and this is my first day back from like 3.5 weeks of leave, so forgive me if I'm a little bit slow off the mark, but as I said, I'm a Barkindji woman from Western New South Wales. It's always very important for us to make sure that we tell you who we are and where our mob is from, and I'm also the current manager of the Juvenile Justice Aboriginal Strategic Coordination Unit. And in a nutshell, the work that we do is to support the agency, particularly the executive and the other areas of the agency, to really embed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander business in the way that we function through our policies and procedures, because we often need a... I'm going to go down a bit. I do community radio, I should be able to get this right. But part of our role is to support the agency in working better with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people and the families in both community and custody. We also look at ways through the corporate plan that we can support the agency to meet its commitments around those issues, as well as coming up, we have an Aboriginal strategic plan, an Aboriginal employment strategy, and a number of specific initiatives aimed at developing a more culturally competent workforce in JJ, so regardless of where you are, Aboriginal young people will have workers who are able to engage with them in an effective way. Families will have workers that will be able to engage them in a way that's going to hopefully help them address some of those underlying issues as a young person in the family. So we're a small unit, but we get through a lot in that small time, and we wouldn't be able to do the work that we do without the support of our elected Aboriginal Strategic Advisory Committee, which is made up of members from across the regions. We have three regions, Northern, Western and Metropolitan, and members of that committee are here today. I'd like to acknowledge Trevor Kennedy, who's our chair, Tamara Saunders, who's the deputy chair, and also the other members that were here that are really the eyes and ears for us out on the ground, who are able to provide us with really good intelligence about what it is that's happening out in the regions, in community and custody settings, so we can go back and better advocate for more positive changes or changes to things that are causing impediments or blockages for us achieving the results we want with Aboriginal young people. So just some statistics, just to touch on a few points from our last from the last seminar. I think everyone knows just how big a problem Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander overrepresentation is here in New South Wales, and that figure alone, 56.3% last year, which is a massive increase from the 47.5% back in 06-07. Now, juvenile offenders are mostly male, aged 15 to 17 years, and are not Indigenous, but the rate of Indigenous juvenile offending is much higher than the non-Indigenous rate. One of the things that I took away from the last seminar is, contrary to a lot of media reports, there isn't a crisis in juvenile offending, but it is high, and particularly so with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people. Now, one of the statistics that popped up that we thought that we should revisit is the fact that in New South Wales courts in 2009, we had over 9,000 juveniles appeared and over 80% were convicted. And most interestingly and most compellingly, from BOSCAR statistics, they indicate that Aboriginal young people are more likely to have their matters go to court, more likely to plead guilty, and more likely to receive more serious and heavier penalties, which asks a lot of questions about what it is we need to be doing to divert more young people into diversionary options, and what else we could be doing, I guess, from a legal perspective around how young people get their legal advice. One really important part of the work that we do is being able to use what the information that we have, the data we have, the feedback that we have from our staff and the anecdotal evidence and research that we're able to pull together. And one of the really important parts of driving a lot of our work is the data from our health surveys. And last year, Justice Health, New South Wales Health and Juvenile Justice completed the Young People in Custody Health Survey. At the moment, it's unpublished, but we'll be sharing some stats with you here today. And the survey found that the high rates of drug and alcohol use, mental illness, parental imprisonment among juveniles in custody was incredibly high. And there are some differences with Aboriginal young people and non-Aboriginal people, but only in a few categories. So I've just got a diagram up here with some of the more pertinent stats from that. And if you go down and have a look, particularly in the alcohol and substance use, you see Aboriginal young people are massively in front of non-Aboriginal young people in terms of parents with an alcohol or drug problem. 81% Aboriginal young people drank at risky levels prior to imprisonment, have had a whole heap of offending that's been related to their drug and alcohol problems, and have been frequent users of various drugs. And some of our respondents were quite young when they had first engaged in the use of cannabis and other alcohols. Mental illness has also been a fairly significant challenge for the organisation as well. A lot of our young people have had high levels of psychological stress at home, reporting of self-harming and ever attempting suicide. And these statistics are incredibly bleak, but one that goes to the issue around intergenerational offending in families, and that statistic was at least 61% of our kids involved in the survey had at least one parent in prison. So while they're bleak, they do provide a really good basis from which we need to work in juvenile justice around, well, what do we need to be doing now that we know these things, and other parts of the research that we do from our workers and from other bodies that we work with, what is it that we can be doing to do better? So we have a couple of key programs within the organisation that go to some way. Some are very high end and some are easier than others. And one of the really important programs that's just started is our intensive supervision program in New South Wales. The pilot has begun in Newcastle and in Western Sydney, and it's been in operation in May since 2008. And it's based on a multi-systemic family therapy model. And it's aimed at juveniles who commit serious and or repeat offences. And they work with the family, a team of clinicians and an Aboriginal team advisor work with families that volunteer to participate in the program. And they get worked through in the sense of, let's identify what it is that's driving the behaviours in this family to be in such a negative way. So they get lots of support to identify problems. For some families, it's the first time they've ever sat down and actually communicated with one another to identify what it is that mum does that annoys us, or what they do, what the kids do to annoy them. But it was a very important model. Over 30 participants have been through the program. 12 of those have been Aboriginal families who have successfully completed the program, and a lot of the feedback from the families has been around, we feel like we can function better, we feel like we can manage our child's challenging behaviours, and that we're in a better position to provide more supervision and discipline with the family. I'm hurrying along here because I'm worried about time. But some of the specific details of the work that they do is our teams work with young offenders and their families to provide parents with some extra skills and resources. So it's a very cooperative relationship where they identify what kind of tools they need to give families to work better together, do a lot of work to practice out ways that they might decide to resolve conflict as opposed to arguing and yelling and being uncooperative in the family setting. The teams also work with schools and principals as well as the New South Wales Police and look at how they can link that family, because a lot of these families are families that don't access services, whether they'd be Aboriginal or mainstream services, and so the work is around trying to get them linked in so they know where to go when they need support. They know who to call if they need an extra little bit of hand. It's been very, very, very positive in that sense, because linking families in with the right kinds of services that can provide the things that they need are often a very good starting point. Now, we've got an internal review of the outcomes for the families, and over 87% of them, both the caregivers and the parents, again felt that the program was an incredible success for them, and felt that for the first time it was a program that could give them something that they could take away and help in the family a little, help function the family a little bit better. The approach of intensive family-based modelling has been something that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities across New South Wales have been talking about for a very long time, because a lot of our families are very interconnected. There's a lot of different ways that you can work with different families, but that holistic approach of working with the whole family but not individual members in isolation is one of the key aspects of making it work for our families. Another really good program that the agency has established is the Act Together Now Strong ANTS model, which was designed by Western Region staff and offered to all staff as a new initiative for working with clients and their families. Now, the ANTS model provides structure around Professor Chris Trotter, which some of you may know, of Monash University's collective family problem-solving approach, and he's made some very specific adaptations to working with Aboriginal families, so it's a little bit more flexible in its approach in addressing the very specific needs of some Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families. Now, all staff have developed skills and confidence around working with the whole family. And then when they've got issues raised that are impacting on the family unit, they've got some tools and skills to help work through with that family what it is they need to resolve. Now, another really successful program that we've implemented over the last 12 to 18 months is Thinner You Ali, which is a targeted drug and alcohol program focused on Aboriginal young offenders. The program has its roots in staff identifying that there was a need to develop a specific drug and alcohol program for our detainees and for our young people out in the community. It's a six-step process that goes through working through with young people the things that they need to, I guess, come to grips with and understand about why it is they drink alcohol and why they take drugs, and it's a very important process for them to help develop self-esteem and confidence, and for them to understand the impact and the consequences of that drug and alcohol consumption. I've had the chance to meet a number of young people from different centres who've participated in the program who found it a really worthwhile experience. One of the things that one of the younger detainees said to me from Moga, which really stuck with me, is that they found that the program really made him feel good about himself, and that he wanted to do it again because he wanted to take in more of the information around drugs and alcohol. But it's been something that's been embraced by our workers and something that's really helping some young people. But like all our interventions, I think some young people are more ready to take on board what's happening in the program and are a little bit easier, I guess a little bit more focused and a little bit more in a position to make some changes, because not all interventions work for all young people, but we keep trying to move forward and looking at ways in which programs that we run for all of our clients, not just Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people, can be improved so they're more responsive. The community and custodial services intervention framework and framework for program is something that's established within the agency and helps staff in the centres and the community deliver programs to tackle offending behaviour. And we've got issues like violence, aggressive behaviour, alcohol and drug misuse, which are a big challenge, as you've seen from the results from the survey. Now, we've got our Journey to Respect, which is another flagship Aboriginal program that we have within the organisation, and it's a group session for Aboriginal young males which aims to reduce the incidence of family and intergenerational violence. It's been running for a long time within the organisation and again has that impact of helping young people feel good about themselves, helping them feel more able to understand why it is they behave in the way that they do, and giving them some tools to help them make some positive changes when they leave our care. Now, look, in conclusion, there's a lot of speakers that are going to be talking about a lot of different things today, and one of the things I just wanted to share with you is, you know, working in juvenile justice, being an Aboriginal woman, and with all my other fellow staff members, it's an incredibly hard job. And I think if there was a magic bullet to resolve these issues, we would have been, you know, would have put it into play. But now I always kind of laugh that when I was in high school, my mother had the job that I'm in now. And things have gotten kind of worse since, don't do the math though, things have kind of gotten worse over the years now, and it's an incredibly challenging environment to work in, because you've got your interests as an Aboriginal person within an organisation, but you have to fit into the structure of how an agency runs. And in an agency like ours, it's very operational. There's a lot of safety issues. So sometimes it's a bit of a challenge to get through the things that we know will work with our young people, but we keep plugging away, and it's why we've got such a great retention rate. Over 73% of our staff stay within the organisation, and I think you've got to be there for at least 5 years before you're not considered a newbie. So we've got a lot of passionate and dedicated and committed staff within the centre who work really hard to support our clients, work with other young people, and also support the agency staff and the work that we do within JJ's to try to help improve those outcomes. But a lot of work has been done over the last couple of years about identifying some particular ways forward. And what I wanted to share with you just to end was just some specific things. They're not the be-all and end-all list, but it was a number of things that both international research program evaluation have been pointing us in the direction that we should be going. Again, that strengthening families and increasing parenting abilities is really important. There's a really strong focus on early intervention and prevention. And I think, from my perspective, having done that for 5 years prior to juvenile justice, early intervention and prevention for Aboriginal families is really different to what it is for, say, a mainstream family or in other groups. And a lot of our families are often in incredibly difficult circumstances, have a number of issues that have sometimes excluded them from receiving early intervention and prevention support services, because we're just sometimes considered too far gone to be helped. So it's really important that the work that we do around strengthening families and early intervention and prevention really takes notice of just the positions that Aboriginal families are in. At the point, we're not at the soft end of early intervention and prevention, we're at the very, very pointy end, and that needs to be taken in consideration. Again, that increased focus on building the evidence base. There's conferences over the years that I've been to around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander programs indicate that there's a hell of a lot happening that's making a huge difference in very small communities, but that's just the thing, it's not happening on the broader scale to bring about that more desired, bigger set of changes. And part of the problem is a lot of our projects are very small, and they're very hard to evaluate because their groups are very small, but people are working very hard, not just within New South Wales agencies. We've got our Aboriginal Juvenile Justice Administrators. Peter Muir is the chair of that, who's here today, and they're looking very hard at what it is they can do to help build that research and evidence base, because the stronger that becomes, the more progressed I think we can become in working out, well, what is it exactly that we need to do for our young people. Also, the enhanced service delivery and investments in programs across jurisdictions for the 9 to 14-year-olds with high complex needs. A lot of the actual age of Aboriginal young people coming into the criminal justice system has been dropping over the years. I think it's about 14.4 now, but I can confirm those figures, which is scary because it was around 16 and 15 marks. So our kids are coming into contact with the criminal justice system a lot earlier than they were, say, a decade ago. So it's really important that the 9 to 14-year-olds age group, which everyone's having a much harder look at now, really does get a bit more investment, and there's a lot more rigour around it. A lot of young people, especially Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people, are falling out of school a lot earlier than 14. And not making it through your sentence. So it's really important that we have some investment in those areas. And again, of course, a recommitment to working with Aboriginal communities. I think Tukanda Innanabara is a great example of communities working together with government to establish a service or a program that community identified was a need. That community set some parameters about what it was, and government came together to make it happen. And there's lots of positive examples of that across New South Wales, and we have to remember that. I keep remembering that, and that there are good things. But those partnerships with community are so vital, because they can make or break the success of a lot of programs. and also that increased focus on education and training. A lot of our young people at the time of their offence are not engaged in school and haven't been engaged in school for a significant amount of time, and that's one of the things that we look forward to in the Aboriginal Strategic Coordination Unit, is working with other government agencies to influence and inform them around what it is, what are the facts around Aboriginal offending, and what is it they can do to contribute, because at the end of the day, Juvenile Justice is a very small agency with a very small bucket of money and a very small staff base, and we have a mandate that is very limited. They're either with us for youth justice conferencing or on detention, and then once those mandates end, our contact with them ends. So it's very challenging, and it's very important that non-government organisations, other government agents and people in services look at ways in which they can become more informed about the needs of juvenile offenders and look at ways in which they can incorporate and make our clients part of your core business, because the more support and the more services that young people have in the community once they're released, they can get access to that, they address some of those specific needs that they have, particularly around understanding bail conditions and getting re-engaged back into school. There's lots of services around that can help, and it'd be really important to build those partnerships with the community around what it is that we can all be doing together to help reduce re-offending across Aboriginal communities.
Bye. Anthony Paulson to the lectern to give us a bit of a discussion about Tacandy. Many of you will know Tacandy's now been operating for a number of years, so this is an opportunity to get an update on how the program's going and to talk about some of the characteristics associated with that intervention. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you. I'd also like to acknowledge country, the Gadigal people and the Eora Nation. I'd also like to acknowledge my ancestral lines, the Warramai peoples, Bundjalung peoples on the North Coast, and the speakers, also acknowledge yourselves. All right, so I'm here today to talk about, well, my position. I'm the Centre Manager of Tacandy Innaburra. Tacandy Innaburra is a cultural development centre for 12 to 15-year-old boys. You just tap this down. Yeah, so it's a 24-hour voluntary residential program. We house 14 participants at a time, for a term at a time, and they've got the option if they'd like to, and if the education levels and cultural levels and that sort of stuff, if they'd like to do another term. We target 12 to 15-year-old Aboriginal males, and we also target low to medium risk Aboriginal males as well. We found, I've only been in the position for 7 months now. Prior to my arrival, the centre was having a lot of high-risk Aboriginal boys, and it just wasn't... our staff just didn't have the training to handle some of the situations that the high-risk guys put them in. Like, they had a lot of mental health issues and behavioural issues and all this sort of stuff, and it just wasn't conducive to the environment of the other guys that were low to medium risk and were there for the right reasons. We're located in the Riverina area between Darlington Point and Collyambly, which is about 40k south of Griffith. So our background, for over a decade, or a bit longer, for about 20 years, the local community had lobbied their ATSIC regional council representatives for the establishment of a centre where young people could be taught that there is an alternative in life to the juvenile or the justice system. Successive regional counselling lobbied various governments for the funds to establish the centre. And I believe, Bob, did you actually open the centre? I've seen your name there. Tacandy Innaburra Cultural and Development Centre opened in January 2006. It is an Aboriginal community managed centre running a culturally based residential program aimed at reducing future contact with the criminal justice system by strengthening the boys' cultural identity, self-esteem and resilience. And that's a big one. I think the connection, creating that connection to country, connection to land, connection to community is just the easiest, and it's the way we've got to target these children. Takan Yinnabara philosophy aims to empower Aboriginal youths to develop and draw on their own resilience in order to take responsibility for their own lives, develop strategies to deal with their problems and minimise the risk of becoming involved in the criminal justice system. The promotion of cultural pride, self-identity, self-confidence in Aboriginal youths is seen as central to the development of resilient young men. The program constantly promotes resilience by rewarding good choices and having consequences for poor choices, poor behaviour. Takandi aims to help identify internal and external risk factors that they may face. And there's an abundance more of the risk factors than what I've listed here. These risk factors may include family, friends, community, education problems, health, drug and alcohol, peer pressure, relationships, violence, grief, loss and trauma. I think Edwina definitely covered, you know, some of the problems and that sort of stuff that these boys do face. Some of the strategies that we teach include enhancing their communication skills, just basic communication skills, negotiation skills, conflict management skills, anger management skills, that's a big one. Yeah, our case management team pretty much begins from initial intake through to exit and then aftercare. I think it's the negotiation skills and conflict management skills, that's a massive one, because it only takes, even there, you know, a few of the boys get in a bit of an argument, we sit them down and we take them through that whole process so they understand what that process is about. Because when they're back at school, it only takes that same name calling or whatever behaviours for them to go off tap again and you know, get up another student, become violent. So we're just trying to give them strategies, and over that term, we constantly, you know, drill them about their using those skills, and we reward them when they do, and it's consequences when they don't. So at Takandi, we value and promote a strong relationship between Aboriginal elders and the youths. Strong relationships between participants and other mentors and also elders in within their community, and cultural relevance and involvement of the elders. What we're finding is, well, since I've taken over, that there hasn't been a lot of promotion of the actual centre for the last couple of years, and the involvement within the elders in the further parts of our catchment area, like we've got elders from Griffith, Narendra, Leeton, which is, they're pretty close to where the centre's located. Their involvement's fine, but when we've got kids come from Bathurst, Orange, Parks, we need to get their elders involved as well. So my community liaison officers onto that. So we definitely try to provide, and this is one of the biggest things for a successful centre such as ours, is you've got to have that safe environment for these children. They've got to feel safe if they're going to open up to you, and you want to extract information out of them. You know, if you want to find out what's going on in their lives, you know, why they're misbehaving at school, why they're disengaging from school, why they're committing crimes, all that sort of stuff, you know, you've really got to promote that safe environment. Active engagement of families, carers, schools and communities. Responsiveness to the youth and community needs once identified. The actual centre's got four two-bedroom, fully self-contained units down the back of the centre, and we try to get as many families as we can to come through and visit whilst their child's going through the term, but it's hard to get them there sometimes. But we do get a few families to come through, and we find that in those children, you know, they do the term easy. They love it. Equity of access across communities in the catchment area. So we work in partnership with other government agencies and non-government agencies such as DET, community services, police, Aboriginal land councils and community members. Anyone that wants to become involved with our centre, you know, it's an open door. We do work in partnership with the Department of Education, and I'll go into that a little later, but we've got three full-time teachers that teach whilst the boys are at the centre. And we tried empowerment of participants to return to their communities with goals and dreams. So the whole time that they were constantly trying to base their experiences so that, and trying to build those strategies so when they do get back to their own communities, they've got some form of, you know, somewhere that what they want to do, goals and dreams. So expected outcomes, to promote cultural pride, identity, sense of belonging and self-confidence in Aboriginal youth, to keep Aboriginal youth from coming into contact with criminal justice system, to develop the resilience of Aboriginal youth, to empower participants to return to their schools or community and succeed, to link participants and their carers to community-based services and networks, to develop and promote the education, training and employment potential for Aboriginal youth, to empower Aboriginal youth to draw on their resilience in order to take responsibility of their own lives. And that's, again, they've got to take responsibility of their own lives. They're coming in. We're trying to teach them as much as we can with those strategies and they've really got to take responsibility. So this is our catchment area. There's 62 towns in this catchment area. Some might have 60 to 100 people and some are the size of, obviously, Bathurst, Orange, that sort of stuff. So we go as far west as Bow Reynolds, up through to Lake Jellago, Condo, round Parks, Orange, Lithgow, down to as far south as Albury and back through. So that's mainly Radgery area, and there's a bit of Yorta in there as well. In the last 6 months since I've arrived, we've allocated 2 to 3 spots for Aboriginal young men that are outside of the catchment area, because at the time, the first term that I was there, we were struggling for numbers, but now we've got up over 25 for the next term. So obviously we're starting to create that waiting list, which is good. And we've gone out and have been promoting the centre, and we're promoting for low to medium risk kids. Unfortunately, there's no other centres out there for the high risk kids, and obviously prior to JJ's. If there was to be a centre created for the high risk kids, it'd have to be counselling and psychologists and all that sort of stuff would have to be paramount to work out what their underlying issues are, and then you'd have to have staff that are trained very similar to juvenile justice training, and the whole design of the centre would have to be a lot different to what ours is. So who can use Tikandi? 12 to 15 year old Aboriginal boys. We take first offenders, non-serious offenders, boys who are ready to make that shift, and boys who live in that catchment area, boys who are dropping out, so disengaged from schools. We're targeting the centres made for the Aboriginal boys are disengaged from schools, but you do have to be enrolled in a school because, as I said, we are attached to, or we work in partnership with the Department of Education. Boys coming to notice the police, involved in conferencing, making their first court appearance. Boys who have support from either family, communities or other sponsoring agencies. So a lot of our, in the last 6 months, I've noticed a lot of the sponsors who refer the children are from schools, but we've been out promoting now throughout our catchment area with community services, health, Aboriginal health, all those sort of ones. In our catchment area, a lot of them didn't even know what we're about or where we were or how to use our services. They have to be currently enrolled in school. So who cannot? And this is, girls, they're crying, they're screaming out for something for Indigenous females. It's chronic. Non-Indigenous males, repeat offenders or serious offenders. So if they've gone past that point where I'll have a look at their criminal history, and prior to joining this job, I was 8 years with the New South Wales Police, and I've done 6 years out far west, Broken Hill, worked in Wilkenya, and Indy Ivanhoe, and all those sort of areas where there are a high Indigenous population. And then I transferred out to Darlington Point. This job came up, and I left the police because this is far more rewarding than what I was doing previous. Boys with serious mental health problems. Now, a high percentage of our guys that are coming through there suffer ADHD, ADD, but they're medicated. It's diagnosed, it's medicated, so we can treat that. But serious mental health problems, again, our staff just aren't trained to deal with those sort of problems. Boys that are not currently enrolled at school. And court referrals. I've had probably five guys where the courts referred them through to Candy as a part of their bail condition or some other condition, and they haven't even contacted myself, and it's just not on. And obviously give them a call and say, what's going on here? So the program has four core learning areas: cultural activities to promote cultural pride and identity, self-confidence, which is essential to our participants becoming resilient young men, sport and rec activities designed to build self-confidence and self-esteem, life and living skills, which encompasses activities designed to increase a participant's emotional intelligence and his ability to better manage his own behaviours and to look after himself. So obviously cook, clean, wash and iron. It's amazing, you get the boys to come in and you introduce them to the centre, give them the do's and don'ts, the rules, and then you hand them their sheet, or they go into their room, empty their bags and set it all up, and then if looking at the sheets, and they've got to make their own beds, and sometimes you're sort of sitting there looking at these fellas, what they're trying to do with a fitted sheet is... But, you know, even if that's all that they can take out of our centre, is how to make a bed and do it every morning, you know, that's a success in my book. School-based education with a focus on numeracy and literacy. So our cultural programs, that's a big one, that's also taught in education and one of our programs that we deliver. Aboriginal art and mosaics, Aboriginal woodwork, jewellery, leatherwork, didgeridoo playing, Aboriginal dance, language and men's group. A lot of them really do come out of it on a high, you know, knowing that they can play the didge, dance, and enough Aboriginal language just to get them through, just to keep it alive, because they're not, obviously, in a term you're not going to become fluent, but a few of their key words and that sort of stuff, and they go around and that's all you hear out of them. So sport and rec, swimming camp, fishing, boating, physical fitness. We've got a gym, basketball court, football fields, a couple of golf courses, got a nice pool there, big art room, music facilities and all that sort of stuff. A rock climbing wall as well. We do have six horses at the moment, and the boys, you know, they love their horse riding, some of them, when they're not allergic to them, but they do, because a lot of these guys just haven't had that opportunity to do any of these sort of stuff, like obviously horse riding they haven't, but no, they really enjoy that. Music, that's another way that to really challenge them and engage with them. They get to create their own rap and all that sort of stuff, cut, disc, edit and all that sort of stuff, and they love taking those home. So life and living skills, personal planning, goal setting, behaviour management, awareness of unacceptable behaviours, strategies for self-control, awareness of forms of assault and offensive behaviours, self-advocacy, cooking, cleaning, ironing, washing, personal hygiene. So a lot of these guys, when they do come through, they have had contact with the police. They do know what is wrong and what is right. It's about getting them to understand, you know, you just can't do a lot of things that their mates do that have got in trouble, or they've got to be able to identify the situation before they go too far. So education. Takandina Borough operates in partnership with the New South Wales Department of Education. The participants are temporarily enrolled with Collyambula Central School for a term. The teaching staff consists of three teachers and two teachers' aides. Subjects studied include, but not limited to, numeracy, literacy, Aboriginal history, science, your basic subjects that you learn at school. When they initially enter, they sit tests for the first week or first few days just to see where their numeracy and literacy skills are, and by the end of it, they've risen a lot. And a lot of them, that's one of the biggest achievements that they find when they come out of there is their numeracy and literacy. And they feel that, you know, that when they do go back to school, and they're keen to go back to school to see how much they have learned and to use when they go back to school. In 2008, we had a Deloitte's independent review conducted. So these are some of the interesting facts. Monitoring of past participants suggests that in the years following their time in the program, between 72 and 93% of graduates remained in either full-time school or full-time study. So that's only 2 years after the centre had opened. And in that time, obviously, the 12 to 15-year-old guys, you'd expect, or you'd really hope that they do re-engage with school. The average cost per participant went to Kennedy is at capacity is around $40,000, and this was the biggest interesting figure that I've seen took out of that Deloitte's review. In 2008, New South Wales Department of Juvenile Justice indicated it cost between $278,000 and $298,000 per annum to supervise a young person in juvenile detention. I don't know if that's correct, but I'm assuming that it's going to be close to the money.
Great pleasure that I invite Bob Devis, obviously a person that was central to the establishment of Tikandy and many other initiatives in New South Wales that people will be familiar with while he was Attorney General of New South Wales. Bob, thank you.
Thank you, Garner, and I also acknowledge the traditional owners and indeed thank those others who have been presenting here tonight. I'm here really because I've been part of a federal parliamentary inquiry. I've stopped being in the federal parliament, and the inquiry itself is to report in a couple of months' time. But an inquiry that's been around Australia and has been concerning itself with questions, I suppose you'd say, of greater generality than those that Kate and Anthony have been talking about. That's not to say that I think that what the things that they've been talking about are anything but overwhelmingly important, because what I did notice is that there is far too little research about the kind of things that would stop a young person from continuing to commit crime, what the connections between drug use and mental health might be. It is in these details and the details of the running of an organisation like Tikandy that much work is still to be done. At that wider and more general level, however, I'd just point out that it's 20 years now since the famous Royal Commission on Aboriginal Deaths in Custody told us that social and economic conditions are by far the most important underlying causes of Aboriginal offending. The importance, therefore, of closing the gap strategies, it doesn't need to be argued. But what we don't know is effectively how to put a great many of them into practice. That's the importance of what Kate and Anthony have been talking about. I won't repeat the melancholy statistics that Edwina has given you, but there is one that's very useful to attract people's attention. If you are a young Aboriginal person between 10 and 14 appearing in a court in New South Wales, then there's a 60% chance that you'll be in jail in 8 years. That's a Boxar figure. And by the way, Boxar is able to show that by far the most important immediate factor in Aboriginal imprisonment is alcohol and drug abuse, leading frequently to violence, frequently family violence. And one of the reasons that there are so many young Aboriginal people in prison, in juvenile justice and in prison, is that crimes of violence are the easiest way to get to prison. And if those crimes of violence are associated with a pattern of recidivism, which they are in the case of, or disproportionately are in the case of young Aboriginal offenders, then you have the statistical explanation for why the imprisonment rate begins to be so astonishingly high. There are more young Aboriginal people, young offenders, re-entering New South Wales prisons in any year than there are new offenders entering the prisons. And that means if you can cut the recidivism rate, then you will quickly reduce the imprisonment rate. Indeed, if you can cut the recidivism rate by 10%, that is to say 10% of young men can be stopped from reoffending within 2 years, you will cut the number of Aboriginal people in New South Wales prisons by 400. That's if you did that this year. So it's common ground that there needs to be a hierarchy of intervention programs to break these sorts of cycles. Early intervention programs for young people at risk, the sort of thing that Anthony has just been talking about, and if that program's successful, one is entitled to ask why are they not an archipelago of Takandi and Aburras across Australia. I heard Sam Jeffries of the brilliant new Centre for Aboriginal Excellence at Redfern and Shane Phillips of the Tribal Warrior Association talking just the other day about the really powerful effect of good mentoring programs on young Aboriginal men. There's lots of evaluation now to show that the drug courts and programs like Merit have both a significant effect on offending and reoffending, and to show that they are actually popular with magistrates, which is a useful thing. We've learnt quite recently that circle sentencing could be much improved if we could add an element of supervised treatment to circle sentencing proceedings. There's lots of international evidence to tell us that back-end prison programs and post-release programs in education, in employment, and in drug and alcohol issues has a really substantial effect on reoffending. And if that's the case, then one is entitled to suggest that there should be more money spent on those programs in prison. Again, there have been times, and I've been part of this misapprehension that suggested that where people have suggested that perhaps you couldn't assist people who are in prison, but it seems not to be so, and there is no doubt, as I say, that breaking the recidivism rate is enormously important. Well, so far so good. That's the probably pretty common ground. But in the parliamentary inquiry that I've been just taking part in, there have been a great many people talking to Aboriginal community members, specialist professionals, wanting to lay a special emphasis on the transgenerational nature of the most recalcitrant problems within the Aboriginal community. Now, this is not a new thing, but I think there's a new strength in the perception of the need for transgenerational solutions for transgenerational problems. Richard Matthews, who's the Deputy Director General of New South Wales Health, makes the actually irresistible case that we need a broadly based program of child and maternal health to reduce the number of children who are damaged emotionally in infancy. That's to say, you need a program not merely to bust the cycle of offending, you need a program to bust the cycle of intergenerational family dysfunction and to stop incompetent and abusive parents from producing another generation of poor or violent parents. That means that I am acutely interested in that intensive supervision program begun in 2008 that Edwina has been talking about. There's a pilot program in Sydney and Newcastle and another program in regional towns using the system of multisystemic therapy for whole families, very intensive counselling and treatment to put whole families back on the rails and teach young parents how to do that properly. It can take 6 months, I think it can take longer, and it's very expensive, but not if you compare it to $300,000 a year to keep somebody in juvenile detention. Uh, And it's true, as Edwina has told you, that the first reports, the first tentative evaluations of that program are very encouraging. And if that's so, I think we're talking about something that's kind of new and extraordinarily important, at least the possibility that we can break one of the circumstances that is actually feeding quite directly into the problem of Aboriginal overrepresentation in the correctional system now. Now, the second reliable, or the second most reliable indicator of Aboriginal offending behaviour, it's a long way behind alcohol, but the second most reliable indicator is failure to finish Year 12. And in my formal speech, which is going to be on the web tomorrow, I understand, I don't do PowerPoints, but there is a formal speech there. I give some acknowledgement to the programs of New South Wales Department of Education and Training. For the first time ever, the rates of attendance are actually going up. The numbers of kids being retained through to Year 12 is going up. So we shouldn't get entirely disconsolate about the problems we're talking about. The number of kids in juvenile detention has been increasing, but the number of kids completing Year 12 has also been increasing. It's as well to keep a balance in those perceptions, I think. There may also be some issues about how schools deal with young people that have been expelled, however, and I think maybe there's some more attention should be paid to that. And it would be a persistent theme of mine that you can never have too much cooperation between government agencies in these kinds of matters. I think there's more to be done in that respect. Often, for instance, people who are concerned with issues of criminality don't talk to people in the education system and vice versa, which seems a great pity. But I was struck, and this is the other part of what I want to say to you tonight, I was struck by a particular sentence in the submission made by the New South Wales Department of Education to the inquiry that I've been part of. It says, reports from schools indicate that wherever they work successfully hand in hand with their local community, Aboriginal student attendances and retention improve, as do other outcomes. That is to say, when schools break out of their traditional formal roles and participate more widely in the community, when they relate to community leaders, they often have the ability to bring about a general improvement, not just in what's going on within the school, but in the local community. And there's a recent study, which I commend to those who don't know of it, by the Jumbunna Indigenous House of Learning at UTS, which compares the crime rates in Menindi and Wilcannia. Adjacent towns, very similar circumstances. One of them has a crime rate half of the other. Why is it? Well, there are very specific circumstances that are identified. A lot of them are to do with the families. Some of it is to do with the availability of work. But an important element is, and I'm quoting the research, the strong relationship between the school and the Aboriginal community was identified as a key factor by interviewees inside and outside Menindi, and the school was perceived as playing a key role in neutralising disadvantage. And that school is taking part in a process, that local approach to improved conditions, which some people call community development. Of course, there are lots of successful programs across the diversity of Aboriginal Australia, and I think it's pretty important, especially in a meeting like this, to acknowledge that government departments often have very great difficulty recruiting staff to work in remote areas. Nevertheless, it is impossible to avoid the sense of frustration that Aboriginal people feel about the administration of government services in most places across Australia. I've just been witness to that for a year. And the Jumbunna study that I've mentioned, the Wilcannia study, which interviewed quite a large number of people in both Wilcannia and Menindi, said this: all but one of the interviewees raised the problems associated with disjointed, inappropriate, remote service delivery, which was seen as undermining the building of community capacity or infrastructure. short-term program funding and remotely located staff of multiple federal and state government agencies and NGOs who did not operate in a planned or coordinated fashion were identified as persistent and significant problems. Now, I know that quite recently a remote area service coordinator has been appointed in Wilcannia, but not long ago the Central Darling Shire did a survey of services and found that there were 46 different services from state and federal government departments and NGOs, and none of them were coordinated. There was no coordination amongst them. Informally there must have been some, but in fact nobody knew what anyone else was doing. I think that problem is kind of intractable, because I know that there have been really sincere attempts to fix it in Wilcannia, amongst other places. I think it's just intractable, and during the inquiry that I mentioned, the new Social Justice Commissioner, Mick Gooda, he made this nice remark. He said, "I have worked in government for 25 years and I'm part of the problem." He said, "Forever we talked about the coordination of services to Aboriginal people. My observation is that the only place where coordination happens is the police, is the place that's least equipped to do it, that is, in the Aboriginal community itself." And he went on to say that he thought that government should actually fund the community to coordinate, harmonise government and community-based services at the local level, and I think he's right. There's another really serious problem. I'm now speaking not only of my own prejudice, although I have this prejudice, I'm speaking of evidence given across the country. It's about the way that government agencies, well, with the best will in the world often, but government agencies and great big NGOs look after their own administrative needs before they look after the real life needs of their client organisations. Partly that's because they're worried that someone's going to pinch the money. But the fact is that grant application processes have become quite incomprehensible in many agencies. And if any of you don't know what I'm talking about, ask for a grant application from any of a number of agencies, particularly the Commonwealth ones, and see if you can understand what the bloody thing's about. I tell you. The consequence is, and this is the most serious, this is one of the serious consequences, that if you've got insider knowledge, then you have an undeserved advantage. It's much easier to give money to a big white NGO with its own bureaucracy than to a small black NGO that knows its own community but not the procedures of the department. During the course of the parliamentary inquiry I've been mentioning, most Aboriginal representatives in every jurisdiction wanted to talk about the systemic failure in the delivery of government services and the need to give more responsibility to Aboriginal organisations, including, not least, community justice groups. They wanted to reverse the policy direction of recent years. I say especially it's a Commonwealth direction, but that's where a lot of money comes from, especially under closing the gap strategies. Government, I believe, can actually improve efficiency and avoid many of the endemic problems of disjointed, inflexible, short-term service provision by assisting Aboriginal organisations to increase their capacity to manage and to harmonise government and non-government services at the local level. The job being to build the capacity of the Aboriginal organisation to make the partnerships that will allow services to be delivered. This is not a question of separating Aboriginal organisations from government, it's a question of making a partnership. This is an approach which is called, in the aid sector, community development. It's a method for allowing Aboriginal organisations and community members to identify their local particular needs and to seek to meet them on terms they accept through a process they control, and therefore to be committed to the result. If there is no commitment to the result, then the program will fail. There's now generations of evidence to show that that is so. And by the way, this is not an intervention into the debate that rages at the moment about whether we should put emphasis on rights or upon responsibilities, about whether we should support Noel Pearson or the Dodson brothers. Okay. The fact is that under the kind of approach that we're talking about, there is the capacity to balance out responsibilities and rights. I agree with Noel Pearson that Aboriginal people should not regard themselves only as victims, and those who wish to support them should not regard themselves only as victims. You need a balance, however, of the exercise of rights as well as the acceptance of responsibilities. Of course, I still would assert that government has to provide the basic services, schools and hospitals and law enforcement and great big programs of intensive therapy, but it will do so the more effectively to the degree that it deliberately provides staff who are trained to understand the role that they can have in overcoming disadvantage if they show some respect for Aboriginal traditions and values and they work in cooperation with the community and its leaders with a sense of shared responsibility. Those, after all, are just the kind of principles that Anthony has been talking about in the running of Takandi and Abara. Experience tells us that community workers and government workers, including police, who are to work in remote areas especially, should be recruited and trained with the greatest of care. We are very careful how we choose to send people to Antarctica. I think we should be just as careful how we choose to send them to Wilcannia or Walgett. And the point is that people who are well chosen and know what they're doing will be the best people to ensure that if they help to establish successful programs, then they will also have embedded them in a way that means that the program doesn't just fall over when somebody leaves. At the level of the community, the fundamental problem that I saw in my inquiry was the sense of frequent cynicism that accompanied the failure to be able to maintain government programs that were seen to work. And I remind you, because I've discovered that the word community development is a bit of a provocative notion in some places around government. I think that particularly came out of the federal government during the time of John Howard and the attacks on ATSIC. I'm not defending everything that ATSIC did, by the way, but the notion set in that somehow or other you would deliver government services without Aboriginal organisations, and I'm here to tell you that that's just balmy. Community development is a practice normal in international aid and poverty alleviation programs in villages throughout the third and fourth world. Community development is a method supported by AusAid, the World Bank, the United Nations Development Program, and you can read about it in the publications of Oxfam or the terrific Aboriginal NGO called Indigenous Community Volunteers, ICV, and you can read about it in the publications of the Centre for Aboriginal Economic Policy Research at ANU. But if you think that Aboriginal communities, especially remote ones, have nothing in common with third world communities, well, don't bother. The Central Australian Land Council has just published, well, about a year ago now, has published a framework community development document directed exactly to these issues. Now, finally, I'm not saying that we don't have to ensure the financial probity of Aboriginal organisations, and there have been problems from time to time in the past. Who could sensibly deny it? But I believe that wherever possible, the Aboriginal organisation and its leadership in town or suburb should be assisted to make a program within a flexible budget that will respond to local circumstances. And I think that government could actually save a lot of money doing that, so long as departments actually train their staff. And I don't know whether this is in any way confronting to members of the PSA, but I do believe that staff should be trained in the principles of community development, and that they should learn auditing and continuous evaluation techniques which are framed to encourage the development of the community, not to stifle it. So if you made a summary and you left aside a few very specific things that lawyers are properly interested in, like the working of the bail laws. There's been some improvements in New South Wales to Section 22 of the Bail Act recently, which I believe has seen a reduction of kids on remand in juvenile justice anyway. And if you leave aside the whole problem of driving offences, especially in remote areas, but you shouldn't leave it aside, it's a path by which many boys get into the correctional system in the first place. If you leave those aside, then I would make this summary. Early intervention starting with broken families, remedial school education, court and prison programs to break recidivism, community development programs with improved capacity and greater responsibility for Aboriginal organisations, and we should keep on doing lots more research.
Thank you very much, Bob.